not nearly as adventurous as Jan to try to run Kino up on this. So we are going to try to get through the PDF. So hopefully this doesn't have many technological glitches. So as Paul had said, I work for the project Science Commons, which is a branch of Creative Commons. Creative Commons started off a number of years ago when more content was moving to the digital form, to seek out a way to make it legally and technically possible to remix and reuse and share copyrighted materials. Science Commons came about a number of years afterwards to explore how those reuse and sharing principles could be applied to scientific research. So the talk today focuses on some of our open access work, but also takes it a level further in open content. So Science Commons works to make scientific research slightly more accessible in a number of different forms. This started off clearly with the application of the Creative Commons licenses to scientific communication in terms of open access journals, self-archiving tools, and whatnot, but also focuses on access to the physical research materials, the actual DNA, plasmids, cell lines that are so critical for experimentation in scientific research, and also the semantic web technologies and standards that are needed to be able to make this accessible by machines. So our work at Science Commons, I like to frame it as we're building part of the open infrastructure to facilitate knowledge sharing. The commons boil down to its main four components, include law, content, technology, and community. And in terms of knowledge of what I'm referring to today, it takes it beyond just the traditional scholarly paper to data, ontologies, annotations, and also those physical materials mentioned before, the plasmids and the cell lines. So knowledge sharing, as has been mentioned a number of times over the last day or so, is really at the root of scholarship in science. And the system of publishing is a way of transmitting this knowledge from what we referred to in the past as a paper metaphor, the idea of writing an idea down on a piece of paper and transmitting that to a colleague as a way of sharing information. But with the move to digital, this has all become much more rapid, it's become much more efficient, but it does need to start with the access to information. A number of talks that I've given on open access have focused on the Creative Commons Attribution License as a legal implementation of the open access definition laid out in the Bethesda, Budapest, and Berlin declarations, which Peter and Super and John Walensky have alluded to over the last few days. So I won't spend too much time on that today. But it does involve access to other forms of information, as Jan very nicely laid out, in terms of the data and the other forms of content that really are now just as much a part of the paper as the actual hypothesis and assertions it made. So one of my favorite phrases to go back to is from Thomas Kuhn from the Theory of Scientific Revolutions, saying that scientific revolutions occur when a sufficient body of data accumulates to overthrow the dominant theories used to frame reality, a paradigm shift. Well, it's not new to anyone in this room, I would argue, that this paradigm shift is necessary when it comes to how we think of scholarly publishing, an enterprise that's been around for over 400 years, if you go back to the first English journal in 1665, and beginning to think of papers as containers of knowledge, as much more of a living, breathing document than it was a static, a static piece of paper a number of years ago. But that's preaching to the choir. You know, it's not new to anyone here that this form of scholarly publishing and communication is rapidly evolving. When it comes to the semantic markup now of information, it really starts to show some of the exponential benefits that we can have when we start to think of this sort of information as much more of a network resource with network effects. And so instead of focusing on Thomas Kuhn, which can be slightly outdated for this, I'd like to go to science fiction authors, to William Gibson, who says the future is here, it's just unevenly distributed. This is referring largely to the work that's been done on the technology side. So I cited the examples of the linked data movement, The work done by the World Wide Web Consortium, headed by Tim Berners-Lee, to help develop these standards and to continue the semantic web development, and also our personal work with the semantic web, which pairs very, very much so with these other two communities, for our NeuroCommons project, which was a proof of concept project to see if we could stitch together all of these disparate resources, these knowledge resources, beyond just the paper, to see if we could find answers to more complicated questions in a faster and more efficient way by using the power of the web. But there are layers of resistance. There's technical, semantic, legal, and these are just naming a few, but these are the categories I'll focus on for today. And strangely enough, in the way that I normally format my talks, I'm going to save legal for last. So, as Jan also mentioned in his talk, Jan, I have to say I did guess a number of your talking points today. I hope I'm a little bit on board with this. If we look at the way that scientific research, actually, you know, you'd find that a number of researchers do conduct their research by starting at Google. We've come a tremendous way from this in the last few years. If you look at what's actually in the search string of signal transduction genes and pyramidal neurons, what this search is for are potential gene targets for Alzheimer's disease. And reading 189,000 papers is not the ideal answer. I think at the last time I did the calculation, if you were to read one paper a day, every day of the week, without any new papers being published, it would take, you know, over 100 and something years. And this is just clearly not going to fit within your grant period. What we can get now is a rather comprehensive list of genes using things like this that look remarkably like ViewSource, if you were to look at a web page. And it's crude, and it's wonky, but looking here, you can actually type in an identifier for pyramidal neurons. You can trigger the system to look at all the different PubMed articles and the open access content. And you can actually indicate that you want to focus on not only the genes, but you want to focus on signal transduction. And the answer that you get is that. Now this, as someone with a journalism background, took me about 10 minutes to do once I understood what to look for in a system that our hackers just put together that is similar to a knowledge management system that you'd find internally in a pharmaceutical company. And this was all done just with a little bit of hacking. Now, is this comprehensive? No, but it shows that the power is there. And the technical work is actually much further along than a number of other levels needed for the implementation of these systems. So the traditional transfer of copyright agreement, I'm sure this is very familiar to many people in this audience. This is actually an agreement from Elsevier for one of the University of California libraries. And it, in a lot of ways, can be seen as a way of somewhat breaking the system of being really able to share knowledge, not only in a university setting, but widely. Now, when it comes to databases, excuse a little indicator up here. When it comes to databases, there are the same sorts of legal implications that do break the system. You know, one example here for KEG, which is a very important resource when you're stitching together these information sources. It focuses on genes and genomes, and it has a commercial use clause. Now, when it comes to integrating databases, it's not clear what a commercial use is, and so it's very difficult to integrate that into an open system, and we actually can't. And also focusing on HapMap, which is a little bit more of a promising example. HapMap followed on the human genome work, the human genome which told us, you know, what we have in common. The HapMap project told us, you know, what sort of genetic variations there are, what makes us different. And when the HapMap project was first released, it had a clickwrap license. Now, clickwrap license gives me a little bit of a shudder. You know, I'd like to think that these things will eventually one day go away. But the clickwrap license in HapMap was actually seen as a way of providing rapid access to the information and as a protection to make sure that people that were using the information didn't abuse their patents. You know, as you'll see from this press release that was from the Wellcome Trust and the Sanger Institute in December 2004, this was later abandoned so that it was able to be integrated because the interoperability issue was much greater than people had anticipated. Now, when it comes to this world of integrated knowledge, this is, oddly, what companies think that we're doing with the web. This was recently released by Elsevier. I'm sorry, but only integrating an author interview into a paper that has so many other different points of access. You know, I could be able to order a material. I could be linked to other relevant papers, other knowledge sources. This just isn't going to cut it. And people like stories. This is why open access is so important, because, you know, scientists are people too. And I hate to say it, but we are a long way from publishing in triples. And not all of that delay can be fixed with technology. Semantic agreement is hard. Do you take Ginger the dog here as a computer and what they can actually understand if it's not marked up in a way that is comprehensible by machines? So a way to think of this, of some of the semantic work, I like to think of a cup of coffee, something that I was very much so relying on today coming from the States a few days ago. And then an example of a coffee ontology, for those of you that aren't from the life sciences, of linking these relationships, which Jan gave us an introduction to. But same problem as there is in biomedical sciences and also in climate change research and in geospatial, there are a lot of ways that you can describe a cup of coffee. And it comes down to an issue of choice or interoperability. Pick one. So our narrow commons work, which was our initial focus in the semantic web world, has evolved into a number of different side projects. One of which was this need emerged for common names for different entities. You know, as Jan also has stated, that there is a lot of confusion in this area because not everybody can agree as to what the word gene means, even. Or in the geospatial context, how do you define land when there's traditional knowledge and other aspects that pertain to that? And so our scientists set out to try to form some way to work through this quagmire, and almost creating a Dewey Decimal System for biomedical entities. And by converging on common names, we're able to see that all of these concepts here refer to coffee. You can then do interesting things like this. This is the infectious disease ontology, where you can actually click on a term, you can find more information about it, because it's integrated with other resources that may refer to something that's similar to it. You can bundle these. You can bundle the ontologies and the other information resources to give you a more comprehensive look when you start querying information, so you can start to see how these other resources are integrated. But there also is the data rights conundrum, the legal aspect. The law gets in the way. And open access is a great solution for that, but only if creative expression is covered. Copyright, it's very murky when it's applied to data. We set out a number of years ago, this was now, I think the first meeting was in October 2006, to start convening groups of scientists together to start asking them, you know, what do you think is the best means of sharing data? Now, Creative Commons is largely known for their copyright licenses and being able to take a traditionally restrictive legal regime, turning it on its head and using that to allow for more freedom. Also in the same spirit as open source software and the licenses there. But when it comes to data, it's not necessarily clear. Is there creative expression when a fact is expressed? Copyright doesn't cover that. But how can you necessarily know exactly what that distinction is? And our position on this has evolved. Initially, the only position that we had was to apply a Creative Commons attribution license, the freest of the licenses that we have in the suite, to the database, to the copyrightable elements. But it became a little bit difficult to know when something fell under that umbrella. Is this material? Is it a creative? Is there creative expression? What about when you detail that on paper in a sequence? You start putting that together in different forms. There's also category errors. A number of people on good faith efforts think that by putting one of these free and Libre open source licenses in one of the suite from the Creative Commons, or whether they apply a different regime altogether in one of the open licenses, that they're doing so in the spirit of freedom, that they're doing so to make it so that it is more accessible, that people can, you know, do with it what they want. They can remix, they can reuse, they can create derivative works, they can use it for commercial purposes and non-commercial purposes. But unfortunately, because there is so much confusion surrounding this area, even applying certain licenses can often prove to be much more problematic, where some are possibly scared off because they're not sure if they still have the right privileges over that information, or others that think that they are doing the right thing, but it's just not necessarily clear. Now, when it comes to non-commercial, these are some of the staple trade or staple Creative Commons options. You know, what is a commercial use on the data web? You know, how small does that, like, how much level of granularity does that apply? Does that apply for just one triple, as Jan was laying out? Does that apply to the entire database? Does it apply to one and not the other? What about share alike, which is a principle that's very much so used in open source software, of being able to make sure that the license continues with the information, and that this ecosystem of sharing continues through just a basic basic addition. Well, when it comes to this example, this is John Snow's cholera map, for those that don't recognize it, from 1854. This is the Soho district of London. And what's marked here is the cholera outbreak. And I don't know if you can see the X's. The X's indicate water pumps. And John Snow, the famous epidemiologist, was able to put this all together. He was able to mash up these information in a way before the digital system existed, so that by looking at this and seeing how the outbreaks were around different water pumps, by shutting off a water pump, the cholera outbreak was able to stop. But actually, going back to this for one second, in a modern setting, would you be able to mash up this same sort of information? You know, at the Google API, it's much, much easier to take, you know, say the Google Maps system, and to take, you know, mouse brain slices and images, say from the Allen Brain Atlas. And you can then put this into the Google system, and you can compare side by side the slices of brain. And you can zoom in with the same sort of technology that you'd be able to zoom in on an address and a location. But if this was clinical data, you wouldn't have the same permissions. If it had a share-alike provision, you wouldn't be able to. It would break the interoperability. And also, if it was under IRB approval, and there's a number of other restrictions that may very well prevent this, if not done in an open setting, and create or prevent this resource from being actually released. Even such things as attribution, and the Creative Commons attribution license is the freest form. The attribution requirement is a part of all of the Creative Commons licenses. And the CC BY license, as a number of people have referred to, is a legal implementation of this open access vision. But when it comes to data, it ends up being a tremendous burden for scientists. This is actually an example that was released a number of months ago of what it would actually look like if someone were to formally have to attribute a Wikipedia article. This goes on for a number of pages. It's about 7-point font. It's very difficult. We had a contest in the office to see if anybody could find some of our colleagues' names. But this would be the sort of requirement that could necessarily be imposed upon a scientist. Talk about the incentive system in open access not catching up with the technology. If this was the sort of citation that was imposed, if someone were to query a database in possibly 40,000 different data sources, this could be a big blocking factor for someone to have to be able to do that sort of research. And that's not what we want to impose. And the problem of any license for data, that's not clear. Even getting a lawyer involved, there's no precedent. It's not necessarily easy to understand or discern, or whether it would even stand up in court. And beyond these restrictions for licenses, there also are database protections based on jurisdiction. Luckily, in the United States, there's a pretty good sense of what the public domain is, and we are lucky to not have database protections that are worked into our national law. But say for the EU, there's a sui generis provision. There's also a sweat of the brow or industrious collection provision found in some countries, where if you can prove that you exerted any effort to compile the information into a database and copyright applies, and Crown copyright, in Australia even, copyright does apply to data. in databases. So it just becomes a much more confusing landscape to try to navigate through if you're an individual scientist, if you're a corporation even, if you're an organization. And when it comes to attribution, even such a minute requirement that is so much a part of how science is conducted, about citing the previous people that have worked on a specific paper, an experiment, etc. You know, which one applies, whether or not a copy is made. And citation refers to the norms of science. When an attribution, it's actually enforceable by license. So after convening a number of different meetings, and this went on for maybe, I believe, 18 months before we released one of our tools, the first of our tools for this, in December of 2007, what we heard from the scientists and from the researchers themselves is that there needs to be a legally accurate and simple solution that takes out of the mix the need to be able to discern where the public domain starts and where copyright ends and vice versa. And it needed to be a standards-based approach. Creative Commons happens to be relatively good at standards-based approaches. And so we worked on, at first, this protocol. Now, the protocol is best seen as a best practices document. It's not a license. But it does involve a very specific guidance about how to facilitate the interoperability of scientific data, as you can see in the pull-out box here. Now, when you look at the different Creative Commons licenses and what sort of interoperability there is, it very, very quickly emerged to us that the public domain is really the only way to go. And so what followed from the Science Commons norms, or the protocol for implementing open access data, if you want to look at the long form of it, was a tool from Creative Commons called the CC0 waiver. It's not a license, and it allows the copyright holder, or the person who retains rights over the information, or thinks that they retain rights, to waive those rights, those contractual obligations over the information, and put it as closely into the public domain as they can. And we recommend you enforce such norms as citation and attribution through community norms and not a contract. And so this allows for data extraction, for reuse. It makes it explicitly clear, surprisingly. Many people think of the public domain as a free-for-all or an area of chaos, when it actually creates legal zones of certainty. You know, a copy will always remain in the public domain. You have the ability to use it for commercial and non-commercial purposes. You can redistribute it. And so it seemed to us, and this is our early research and we're still road testing it, to be the easiest way to move forward in this area that was very murky and very dark. It also requires that the provider place no additional obligations that break interoperability, such as share alike, that limits downstream use. Because the truth be told, even five years from now, no one knows exactly what sort of technology, the technology is rapidly outpacing the social adoption of these tools. And it's not necessarily clear what downstream use will be. And imposing those restrictions early on could make it even more difficult in the future. And it requests behavior through norms in terms of use. Now, the norms in terms of use, they vary by scientific discipline. What may work best for physics may not work best for geospatial research, which may not work best for the social sciences. But by having these community norms in the spirit of interoperability, without limiting downstream use, and able to be created by the community themselves, it helps make them adaptable to the different disciplines. And what all this creates is an infrastructure for the data web and the digital commons, which, defined earlier, is a combination of law, open content, the right technology, and the community. Because if you don't have the structure and annotation, it's a lost opportunity. It needs to be in an open infrastructure, support recombination and reconfiguration into computer models, and be queryable by a search engine. Because, as many of us know, we're going to be facing a data deluge if we aren't already. And having machines be able to help us and being able to use the technology that is rapidly being developed is going to become much more necessary in the coming years as it is now, and to remember to treat data as a public good. If property is the accepted metaphor for triples, and the temptation to treat triples even in other forms of data is extremely strong, open licenses aren't always a magic wand. And so we need to resist the temptation to treat data as property, because all of the other limitations, such as ownership and other restrictions, are automatically assumed if it's treated as property. And we need to embrace the potential to treat it as more as a network resource. Because at best, we're partially right. At worst, we're really wrong. But if it's created in an open system, we have the right to fix our mistakes and to continue development. It's much easier to go from an open system and develop than to start with a closed system and move back. Does anybody remember Prodigy and AOL? And how, when the web was being developed, you know, the web in comparison to Prodigy and AOL wasn't sexy, had a lot of bugs, had a lot of mistakes, but it was able to be fixed in an open form and to become the resource that it is today. So I encourage you all to design for maximum reuse, to ensure the freedom to integrate, to make these design decisions at the outset instead of later on down the road when it may be difficult or impossible to come back from that, and to allow for the snap together integration of all these different tools. Thank you.
Okay, we don't have time for a lot of questions, but we can take one if someone's got a question. Okay. Well,
thank you, Fred Friend. I think the big problem we're facing with legal side of data in the UK, and research are facing this, is knowing who owns the data. You know, before you get to your zero waiver stage, let me put it another way. A researcher might say, I'm going to use zero waiver, but then it's discovered a few months later that the researcher doesn't really own the data, that it's his research team or the funding agency or somebody else. So he's going to have a zero waiver, but had no authority to do so. Are you looking at that kind of problem?
It's something that we're readily aware of, because this is very much so an uncharted territory. And you're exactly right. It's as much as it's not clear whether something's under copyright protections or how that may be able to be reused, it's very difficult to necessarily tell who may be owning the data, or if it's owned by a group, or if it's legitimate, regardless. And so we're using this as a testing ground to see how to move forward. I mean, ideally, in a number of years, these sorts of freedoms will be built into funding agreements and things, so that it will be very clear, through the universities, through the funding agencies, that, okay, it's data, we're going to relinquish the ownership in the spirit of it being a public good. But as of right now, it's not clear whatsoever. Even in terms of data that's already in the public domain, through whether it's through the U.S. government or the Geological Survey or whatnot, it's not always clear how someone may be able to, put the waiver on that, even if it already is supposed to be in a free form. So you're exactly right, and we hope that in the next year or so that there will be much more research into this, and we're going to continue our research in this to see if there is a way that we can navigate that.
All right, well, once again, thank you very much for coming and speaking. Yeah.